Welcome to The Buzz. I'm Christopher Conover. This week, we sharpened our pencils and headed back to school to learn more about English language learning in Arizona. In recent months, the debate over dual language programs has come back into the political spotlight as State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn calls for the end of that model. He claims that the 50-50 learning structure breaks state laws that ban bilingual education for English language learners. We spoke with the Arizona Republic's Daniel Gonzalez to better understand what the battle is all about.
So in 2000, there was a voter initiative that was put on the ballot. It was funded by a California businessman named Ron Unz. And he was a proponent of English language immersion for English learners. His contention that was that bilingual education was ineffective, and that if you wanted to be successful in America, you needed to master English. So, and at the time, Arizona was going through some tremendous demographic changes. Back in the late 1990s, there was the start of this very large influx of migration to the United States from Mexico that was really being driven by economic conditions in Mexico and a strong economy in the United States that was pulling a lot of workers here. So anyway, this ballot initiative came along that banned bilingual education and required that English learners be taught only in English. And it passed by a pretty substantial margin. So then shortly after that, Tom Horn, I think in 2003, was elected to become the superintendent of public instruction. And he was a very strong proponent of this English-only immersion approach. He instituted a model that was underneath this policy. And under this model, English learners were required to be pulled out of their classrooms for 4 hours a day, which is a significant amount of time. And during that time, they would receive only English instruction, you know, learning grammar and spelling and all the fundamentals of learning an English language, with the idea being that they would learn English very rapidly within a year and then transition to mainstream classrooms. The problem, though, the issue, there's kind of two big issues here, is that during that time, students were essentially segregated from their peers, so they didn't have a chance to be speaking English with their classmates, which is a lot of times where you learn English. And also, they were not receiving their academic instruction. The big chunk of their day was focused only on learning English, not on things like science and social studies and math. So they were falling behind. They were not transitioning out of these programs within a year. It was taking a much, much longer.
I got here in 2005, and I remember all of this going on because it was still relatively new at that point. It seemed to have disappeared for a while, and then it popped back up. Is that because Tom Horn reemerged after being out of the political scene for a while, or did something else bring it back to the forefront?
You know, over time and as data started to accumulate, it started to become clear to policymakers and lawmakers that English-only immersion, this four-hour model, was not working. English learners were consistently scoring at the very lowest rung on standardized tests, lower than any other demographic group, including children who were homeless and children with disabilities. Only about 2-3% of English learners were passing, you know, English and math standardized tests. There were some attempts to repeal Prop 203, but the only way that can be repealed is if it goes back to the voters. And so that the legislature or somebody would have had to put that back on the ballot. They didn't seem like they had enough votes to do that. So what the legislature did was they put together legislation that reformed Prop 203. It was spearheaded by Republicans, it should be noted, and it passed with unanimous support from Democrats and Republicans in both chambers of the legislature. It basically directed the State Board of Ed to come up with new models to replace that four-hour model and give schools more flexibility in teaching English learners. So the board came up with three English immersion models. It reduced the 4-hour mandatory block to 2 hours, so there was less amount of time. And then it also allowed kind of different configuration. And then they came up with a fourth model, which was called the dual language immersion model. Lots of schools already had dual language programs of their own during this period. But what this legislation and this model that was created by the board did is it allowed now English learners to participate in dual language programs. And dual language programs essentially are, you spend half the day learning in English and half the day learning in another language, which is typically Spanish. And you're not just learning those languages, you're learning all of your academics in either English or Spanish as well. So it means, like, you know, math could be taught in Spanish or social studies could be taught in Spanish part of the day, with the idea that students come out of these programs of being both bilingual and biliterate. You know, ideally, under these programs, you'd have a mixture of kids who are still trying to master English, become proficient in English, and students who, you know, already are fluent in English, and they'd be learning from each other and from the teachers. The pandemic hit in 2019. That made it difficult for schools to implement these programs, and then they were starting to gain some momentum, gain steam. Schools started to adopt them, and then Tom Horn was elected. Now, this is when it has kind of boiled up into a controversy again, because Tom Horn is contending that English learners, by law under Prop 203, shouldn't be in these programs.
Your reporting has taken you into some of these classrooms, and of course, as you said, the pandemic turned everything on its head. But for folks, our listeners, who haven't been in the classrooms, how does that work? You kind of described it a little bit, that part of the day, maybe you're learning math in English or in Spanish or whatever the two languages are. If you're up north, it might be in the Navajo language or something like that. But what does it look like since you've been in the classrooms?
I had the opportunity to visit the dual language program at an elementary school in Glendale Elementary School District. And it was really fascinating because basically you have a classroom of students, and those students are split up into two groups. And each group stays with each other through the school year. One group that I visited in the morning, they spent the entire morning in a classroom that was being taught entirely in Spanish. So you walk into this classroom, there's flags from different countries of Latin America. There are, you know, important cultural and historical figures of Latin America on the walls. And then the teacher is only speaking in Spanish. So, you know, the day that I was there, I think they were giving some lessons on Cesar Chavez. It was around Cesar Chavez's birthday. What was fascinating, I can't remember what grade it was. I think these were third graders. But what was really fascinating is that this classroom was made up of students, some students who spoke Spanish at home, but a lot of these students didn't speak Spanish at home. They were learning Spanish, and it was very obvious that they understood everything that this teacher was saying to them in Spanish. She would ask a question and they would, you know, raise their hands and answer in Spanish. So, and then while I was in this classroom, then we walked over to the classroom next door where there was another teacher who was teaching in English. And I think she was doing, they were going over some composition that day. And in her classroom, all the signs and everything on all the bulletin boards were all in English, and the teacher was speaking in English. And then what happened was at noon, they would have lunch. The students would switch places. The teachers stayed in their classrooms, so the students now moved to the other classroom. So the students who had been in the Spanish language classroom in the morning, they'd go to the English language classroom in the afternoon, and vice versa.
So, and as you said, there were kids in the Spanish classroom in the morning who at home didn't speak Spanish, so they were learning Spanish. And then in the afternoons, there were kids who spoke Spanish at home in the English language classroom who were learning English. So everybody moves to bilingual, or a lot closer to it, in theory, as time goes by.
Yes, and I should note that under this model, it's meant to satisfy the requirement of Prop 203 that you receive, you know, a certain amount of English instruction a day. Now, the issue, though, here, kind of the bone of contention with Tom Horn is the Spanish-speaking part of the day. He fixates on there's language in Prop 203 that says English learners should be taught only in English. So what he's saying is by putting those students in these programs, the English part of the day, perfectly fine. What's not okay is when they go to that Spanish part of the day because they are being taught in Spanish. And in his view, that violates Prop 203.
So obviously the courts are going to get involved again, I would think, here fairly soon. What's the future look like? And not that we reporters are particularly good at predicting the future necessarily, but the short term, what does the future look like for Arizona's English language learners?
Under civil rights laws, schools are required to provide the special services to English learners so that they don't fall behind. As a parent, you can say, well, I don't feel like my student needs these services, so I'd like to exempt the school from having to provide them. So those students could participate in dual language programs. But basically, Tom Horn said is he went after these programs and said, if you allow students to participate in these programs who are English learners and they don't have a waiver, then I'm going to withhold educational funding from you. The attorney general weighed in and she said, no, these are models that are approved by the board. And English learners can participate in them, and they don't have to have waivers. Tom Horn has now told me just yesterday that he's preparing to file a lawsuit to have the courts rule on whether dual language programs in themselves are in compliance with Prop 203. So in the meantime, schools can continue to allow English learners to participate without waivers. The question is going to be, you know, what will the court say? He might have a strong case. He's obviously not going to give up on this. It's going to be a battle, I think, we're going to see play out over the next year. But in the meantime, English learners can continue to participate in these programs.
That was the Arizona Republic's race, equity, and opportunity reporter, Daniel Gonzalez. We're learning about the nuances and noise surrounding English language learning in Arizona. AZPM reporter Paula Rodriguez introduces us to the Vega family, who recently enrolled their oldest daughter into a dual language program.
I'm Elena and I'm 5 and I'm starting to go to kindergarten.
I have a couple questions for you. Is it okay if I ask you some? Okay. Are you excited for school starting?
Yes.
What are you most excited about?
Playing at the playground.
Elena Vega has a lot of new things on her plate when she starts kindergarten next week. Not just a new school, but a new type of curriculum. What were your thoughts when you found out that you're going to be learning Spanish?
A little nervous.
Why?
Because sometime when I start new schools, I'm a little nervous that I have fun.
Elena's parents, Hector and Brittany, decided to enroll her in a dual language immersion program this fall. But Elena is not the type of student most people think of when they hear about dual language programs. She is already fluent in English and wants to learn Spanish.
Growing up, my dad would always tell me this phrase, el bilingüe vale por dos, which I would translate that like somebody who's bilingual is almost two types of people. You're the person that speaks your native language, and then, you know, you speak the different language. And I think any language that you learn is just, it opens doors to so many opportunities and experiences throughout the rest of your life.
Spanish is essential in the Vega household. Elena's dad, Hector, and his siblings immigrated from Mexico to Phoenix when he was just 4 years old.
I didn't know any English at the time, neither did my brother. We were all very little. But at the time, they must have had some kind of programs like these for us. You know, half a day is Spanish, the other half is English. And I think that helped us out incredibly. And here we are, trying to do the same thing for her in a different language.
For Hector, English language learning was essential for his transition into the United States. But for Elena, Spanish language learning is essential for her connection to her roots and family. Elena's mom, Brittany, says Hector's parents only speak Spanish, creating a language barrier between Elena and them.
It just makes it harder to have a relationship with, you know, your grandkids when they don't really understand what you're saying.
And teaching Spanish in the house was not a viable option for the Vega family.
Trying to incorporate speaking Spanish into the house is difficult. I mean, it's something that I'm willing to do, but it makes everything a lot more difficult. And when you've got two young kids, it's just like sometimes that's just one extra thing that you can't deal with at the time.
Dual language immersion was the only option that made sense for the Vega family. With Hector experiencing the learning model firsthand, he knew of the success that came with such a model. But he also knows of the negative consequences of an English-only immersion model, since his brother did not have the same opportunity.
When he was starting at school, it got taken away from him, and he had a lot of issues. He, you know, he failed to proceed to the second grade or third grade.
Now, Hector believes he was able to have opportunities that his brother did not have because of that. While there is no Spanish-only immersion model that would risk similar outcomes for Elena, Hector's experience with dual language immersion proved to be enough for the Vega family to choose this option for her. Though the choice did not come without sacrifice, the Vega family moved away from Kino Valley, the town they called home for 15 years, to bring new opportunities for their daughters Elena and Anna. But while there will be further distance between Elena and her grandparents, she will now at least be able to communicate with them and maybe create a new atmosphere at home.
I mean, I kind of envision, you know, her coming from school and, you know, start speaking Spanish to me or say, hey, I learned this today.
I'm Paola Rodriguez for The Buzz.
Proponents for dual language learning claim that it is the most effective model for students looking to acquire a second language. Julia Sugarman is the Associate Director for K-12 Education Research at the Migration Policy Institute and has spent her career researching effective literacy methods. I started our conversation by asking how English-only immersion models compare to dual language.
From about 50 years of research, the dual language model is really the most effective model for long-term outcomes in terms of academic achievement, English proficiency, and of course, students also are able to maintain their own language, so they actually get something more.
Obviously, developing the native language is important. You want to talk to grandparents and not lose culture and things like that. But Arizona, we're still the only state that has an English-only immersion model on the law books. When it comes to, and I don't want to set the cultural aside because it is important, but really focusing on the classroom at this point, how does that English-only immersion affect students in the classroom when it comes to learning and working with their peers?
You know, it's really understandable why people believe that if you want to learn English, then you should be immersed in English and do all of your work in English. But what we know from research is when students are developing both languages at the same time, they're able to use both languages and think about both languages, something we call metalinguistic awareness. And that actually helps them develop the skills in English. Those of us who learned a second language in middle school or high school, as I did, know that we actually gain skills in English, in understanding English grammar, because we studied, for example, French or Spanish.
As students move through their academic career, that K-12 range especially, how likely is it that English language learners, as they move on, will end up in advanced courses, be it honors courses, advanced placement, or do they always find themselves maybe at best in the middle of the pack courses and at worst in some of the remedial stuff?
This is a really great question. It's something that's been coming up in research a lot lately. I mean, I think that we, on the one hand, we do know that students who are bilingual and are very strong learners in both languages tend to get better test scores, have better outcomes. And so one might say, you know, that they are more likely to do well in those advanced courses. But I think that the view of this question has changed less you know, who should be in those courses, as to how can we support all students in those courses. You know, since the beginning of the dual language movement, you know, we've been saying it really should be a K-12 course, and we should have students taking, you know, not just AP Spanish if they've been in a Spanish dual language program, but AP other coursework, you know, just like we do, you know, students do in college. They take other kinds of history courses or other kinds of courses in another language. And that's certainly something that dual language advocates have been suggesting for a very long time. The trick is those classes can be very hard to pull off, and, you know, finding the right teacher and the right materials and making sure there's enough students who have the language skills to be able to do the, you know, the rigorous coursework at that level. But certainly, you know, having in high school, having a course that would be available to students who came through a dual language program, as well as kids who immigrated more recently, and who are, you know, at that level in their native language. There's no reason a student who's come through, you know, K through eight in Spanish shouldn't take a ninth grade course in social studies in Spanish, because they're, you know, perfectly ready for that. And that could be really beneficial, because they're developing their cognitive skills, they're developing their really high level critical thinking skills in the language that they know, and at the same time, they're developing English. So both of those things are happening simultaneously.
When it comes to metrics like English language proficient, how does Arizona compare nationally? Because obviously this is not just an Arizona issue. There are plenty of states where kids come into the school system speaking different languages, not even Spanish necessarily.
We don't have a lot of great comparative data across states, because for one thing, states use different tests for English proficiency. And so there's a huge number of states that use something called the Access for L's, developed by the WIDA Consortium. Arizona is not one of them. Arizona uses its own test. And I think the other thing is that we just don't have great national data. Even if you were to assume that, you know, a proficiency rate, you know, the number of students who score proficient in one state is comparable to another state, we just don't really have that data available. You really kind of have to dig for it. Arizona is at about, I think, 9% of students achieving proficiency. And we don't really have a number that we would say, you know, a state should be at this level or at that level. But if you think about the general guideline that students probably ought to score proficient within about 5 years, you might say about one fifth of students ought to be scoring proficient every year, which is about 20%. The other issue is looking at the goals, the growth towards proficiency. And a lot of states are not actually reporting that on their state dashboards because it's not required. So we really only have that proficiency number, and we don't have the progress towards proficiency, which I think is actually a better number. And I think is, you know, something that we would want to track in each state or nationally. And at this point, we're really not able to do that.
You said Arizona's at the low end of English proficiency, 9%, where most states are in that 10 to 20 range. But data shows 2% of English language learners in Arizona are passing standardized tests in math and reading. Obviously, 2% is a very low number. What, from your perspective, does Arizona need to do to get this program moving more quickly in the right direction?
Yeah, and the 2% number is even more concerning when you consider that they actually also include some students who have transitioned out of English learner status. So for federal reporting, you're allowed to use 4 years of data after the student has actually stopped being an English learner. So that 2% is probably, I mean, I would have to look at the numbers, but that 2% is probably mostly kids who have actually exited English learner status and not current English learners. But, you know, I think this is really an indictment of the structured English immersion program that had been going on for a long time. And they have made a number of changes. And I think it's just going to take a little bit more time to see the fruits of the labors of, you know, the state folks and all throughout the districts that are trying to learn these techniques for teaching content to students who are developing English.
At the beginning of the interview, we talked briefly about the cultural aspect of all of this within families, within communities. Does dual language help more with preserving cultures?
In a two-way dual language model, you have the kids from two groups. You have the native speakers of English, who are, you know, typically white or African American or other or heritage language speakers, people who've been here a few generations. And then you have native speakers of the partner language. And so the beauty of that model is that everybody really gets to know each other. Everybody gets to appreciate the other culture, and they get to understand at a really deep level what it means to be, you know, an Anglo-American or Hispanic American. And more importantly, understanding that people are different and that's all right. And that you can still get along with people who are different from you.
When we think dual language, we think Spanish, because we border Mexico and we have a long cultural history. But nationally, are we talking about just Spanish English, or are there a lot of other languages in other communities across the country that are dealing with this that are not Spanish?
Arizona still is very heavily Spanish, but you know, in a lot of the rest of the country, it's really diversifying. Among the recent immigrants, only about half of them speak Spanish. So the groups of folks who are coming now really speak a huge range of languages, and that's why dual language doesn't work everywhere, because you can only really do it in a place where enough kids speak the language. And so we're always going to have to be thinking about how to provide a variety of different kinds of programs to fit these different communities and populations and capacities of schools.
That was education researcher Julie Sugarman. And that's The Buzz for this week. You can find all our episodes online at azpm.org and subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for The Buzz Arizona. We're also on the NPR app. Paula Rodriguez is our producer, with production help from Desiree Tucker. Our music is by Enter the Haggis. I'm Christopher Conover. Thanks for listening.
Arizona Public Media's original programming is made possible in part by the Community Service Grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.